This is VOA News. I'm Lori London. The mail bomb scare in the United States is widening, with law enforcement officials seizing three more suspicious packages. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports from the White House.
Two were addressed to former Vice President Joe Biden and the other to actor Robert De Niro. Both have criticized President Trump, as have others who received similar packages. The president called out political violence yesterday, saying all sides should unite.
In peace and harmony, we can do it.
At the same time, he is blaming the media for not setting a civil tone. Critics say his own rhetoric has led to a sharp and potentially dangerous political divide. But spokeswoman Sarah Sanders says there's a big difference between words and deeds.
The idea that this is at the hands of the president is absolutely ridiculous.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
Saudi Arabia has again changed its explanation for the killing of a Saudi journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, inside Riyadh's Istanbul consulate, now saying it was premeditated based on information it had received from Turkey. Reuters reporter Emily Wither has this.
Two sources have told Reuters that CIA Director Gina Haspel has heard an audio recording of the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Haspel arrived in Turkey Monday as part of a fact-finding mission into the dissident's murder. Reuters was told that an audio recording existed of what happened inside the Saudi consulate on October 2nd. It's also been widely reported in the Turkish media, with some revealing gruesome details of the journalist's torture and interrogation.
A strong earthquake off the western Greek tourist island early Friday morning was felt as far away as Athens in the capital of Athens, and as far away as Italy, Malta, Albania, and Libya. This is VOA. Japanese freelance journalist Junpei Yoshida is returning after being released by his abductors in Syria following 3 years in captivity. He said he's happy to go back to Japan. He said he hadn't spoken Japanese in 40 months. Yoshida walked into an immigration office in the southern Turkish city of Antakya Tuesday. The circumstances surrounding his release remain unclear, but a senior Japanese government spokesman said Qatar and Turkey had negotiated his freedom. U.S.-led international forces in Afghanistan have temporarily scaled back face-to-face contacts with local partners after two insider attacks in the past week that killed a revered top Afghan police chief and a foreign service member. A spokesman for NATO's Resolute Support confirming Thursday while speaking to VOA that the current situation has prompted the mission to introduce measures to ensure the safety of American and other foreign troops. On Monday, an Afghan soldier shot dead a Czech service member and wounded two others at a military base in western Herat province. That happened just days after a local security guard, a purported Taliban infiltrator, opened fire at a gathering of top Afghan and American military officers in the southern province of Kandahar. Taliban insurgency claiming responsibility for both of those attacks, saying its infiltrators among Afghan security forces carried them out. An insurgent spokesman asserted the attack in Kandahar was meant to assassinate both General Miller and Razik. Britain's Information Commissioner Office has slapped Facebook with a fine of $644,000, the maximum possible for its behavior in the Cambridge Analytical scandal. AP correspondent Zuria Shakely reports.
The ICO's investigation found that between 2007 to 2014, Facebook processed the personal information of users unfairly by giving app developers access to their information without informed consent. The fine was a maximum allowed under the law at the time the breach occurred. Had the scandal taken place after the new EU data protection rules went into effect, the amount would have been far higher. Zara Shackley, London.
A U.S. official confirms to VOA the Pentagon has received a request from the Department of Homeland Security for U.S. military troops to assist Border Patrol agents to prevent a caravan of Central American migrants from entering the United States. More than 2,000 National Guard troops have already been deployed to the area. I'm Lori London, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia has its first woman president in its modern history.
I'm pleased that they decided to appoint her, and that would serve as an encouragement to our women and girls that have been marginalized for too long in this country.
Beyenin Petros is the leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party of Ethiopia. We'll look at what NATO is doing to help stabilize Africa. South Sudan's government releases more political prisoners and villages are burned as the Cameroon government targets separatists.
The government has been attacking the ones fighting for the restoration of independence of southern Cameroon. In Garoum, a lieutenant was killed, as well as two military officials. Civilians were killed, including a councillor.
Debin Chofo is governor of Cameroon's Northwest Region, and the 154 Contemporary African Art Fair continues to expand. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An opposition leader in Ethiopia says the appointment of the country's first female president in its modern history will serve as an encouragement to women and girls in Ethiopia who have been marginalized for so long. Beyenin Petros, leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party, made the comment in reaction to the appointment Thursday of Saliwak Zodi, a seasoned diplomat, as president. While the position carries a significant social influence, it is largely a ceremonial post. Professor Petros says Zodi's appointment is a positive step, but he says the opposition is still waiting to see if Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's promises of reform will be followed by the enactment of the necessary laws, engaging the opposition directly and holding free and fair elections so that Ethiopians can have a say in who their next leader will be.
My reaction is very positive, and the appointment is not just only a woman, but she is a professional diplomat of long standing, and I'm pleased that they decided to appoint her, and that would serve as an encouragement to our women and girls that have been marginalized for too long in this country.
You said that women and girls have been marginalized. She has promised to raise the status of women. She says that she wants to promote gender equality in Ethiopia. What does that mean?
That's a positive intention, and we want her to do rather more on this issue, which has been neglected for far too long. So it's just encouraging to hear that she has resolved to promote the cause of the woman in Ethiopia.
You are an opposition. Talk to me about the appointment of the new woman president and the new changes that the new prime minister has brought about. What does that mean for Ethiopian politics?
Well, I feel it is this is a positive, kind of position taken by the new prime minister, and encouraging to continue to do such positive, appointments, which has a far-reaching implication as far as promoting, the well-being of large majority of women, which are or more than 50% of the population in Ethiopia.
So do you think things are looking up for the opposition in terms of broadening the democratic space?
So far, it is, much of it is promises. We are waiting to see the promises to be followed by the necessary laws and procedures in place. And also, the new prime minister, although he has been doing lots of fine things and taking positive steps, we are yet to see him and his government engaging the opposition on discussions and negotiation of the political landscape, which is rather missing for too long in this country, and it's a source of misunderstanding, and we want these promises translated into appropriate laws and procedures in place.
But you will agree that the appointment of this woman president is a step in the right direction.
Yeah, we accept that as a positive move. And life does not simply stop there. There is, you know, the huge need for conducting a fair, free, and a genuine election in this country so that the population will decide who or which party or parties should be empowered in the next round.
Thank you very much again, sir. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you.
I appreciate it that you have, you know, called me and wanted my opinion on this important issue. Thank you very much.
Benyamin Petros is the leader of the opposition Social Democratic Party of Ethiopia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Addis Ababa. Thousands of people fled the volatile English-speaking regions of Cameroon before the October 7th presidential election. Now, some are returning to find their home, their houses and villages burned to the ground. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Bamenda, northwestern Cameroon.
Separatists pushing for an English-speaking state vowed to prevent any voting in northwestern and southwestern Cameroon and attacked many polling places on election day. 18-year-old Christa Banla fled her village of Ngarum for a town in a French-speaking area after incumbent President Paul Biya was declared winner of the election. She decided to go back to her village, thinking that peace had returned. Instead, she found her home torched to the ground. The military had attacked the village and other areas where they believed armed separatists were hiding or holding training camps.
They came and drove all of us out of the compound. We're only coming back in the evening to discover that the compound was destroyed by military and burned down. We don't even have food to eat, no clothes to wear. We need help.
Emmanuel Chuye, mayor of Ndu District, which includes Ngarum, says that after the election, the government ordered the military to attack suspected separatist strongholds. He says many people are being killed and their houses torched by both the military and the separatists.
The government has been attacking the ones fighting for the restoration of independence of Southern Cameroon. In Ngarum, a lieutenant was killed, as well as two military officials. Civilians were killed, including a councillor. They were not only killed, they were burnt, and the houses too were set ablaze.
The government has not given casualty figures of the recent fighting, but local media reports that at least 30 civilians, soldiers, and suspected separatists have been killed in the northwest within a week. Northwest Region Governor Deben Chofo confirmed the military is at work in the region, but said soldiers are not killing indiscriminately and burning villages. He says the attacks will continue until peace returns to the region.
Government have taken necessary measures to secure the remote areas, neglecting nothing that can hinder the global security of the nation.
Unrest began in Cameroon in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers demonstrated against the overbearing use of the French language. Separatists took over and demanded the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest secede from the rest of the country. The United Nations reports at least 400 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands have fled their homes. At least 20,000 have fled to Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bamenda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Friday, October 26th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government on Thursday released five prisoners of war in Juba, including an opposition general held by national security agents for the past 11 months. Some key opposition detainees, however, are still believed to be in government custody. Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
A national security official who declined to identify his name read a statement to the media before the detainees' release at National Security Headquarters, sometimes known as Blue House, saying the National Security Service, or ISB, was acting on a decree issued by President Salva Kiir.
The ISB acting on the order of the president is releasing its last remaining political detainees and prisoners of war who have been arrested in connections with insurgency and rebellions against the state. This gesture is in compliance with the Republican Order Number 14.
The official said the five men released are the last group of prisoners of war under the custody of the National Security Service. Opposition groups dispute that claim. The SPLMIO says Dong Samuel, James Gadet, and Agri Idri and other SPLMIO rebels are still missing. The five detainees freed were paraded before the media at National Security Headquarters wearing clean, pressed clothes and neatly combed hair, but their skin looked rough. SPLMIO Governor-designate of Kapoita, Marco Lokidor, who was held for the past 11 months, says he and the other four men are grateful for their release.
We also want to thank the Institution of National Security for their full protection to political detainees and other detainees. We are very grateful. And now, on behalf of the political detainees, we also urge the international community, including the IGAD, the region, to support fully the implementation of Rift Alliance peace agreement. We need peace in the country so that the country to come back into normality.
Lokidor confirms that detained activist Peter Beer and entrepreneur Kerbino Wall are still under detention.
No, we are not the only, but we have some detainees who have different cases.
The peace deal signed last month by President Kiir and opposition groups in Ethiopia demands that all parties cease hostilities and release all prisoners of war as well political detainees in their custody. The government has scheduled a peace celebration in Juba for next week to the tune of $3.5 million. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From uncontrolled migration in the north to the rise of Islamist terrorist groups to political instability in places such as Libya, Mali, and Somalia, African security issues continue to pose a threat to Europe and the rest of the world. NATO's command senior enlisted leader for Allied Command Operations, Command Sergeant Major Davo Peacock, spoke exclusively with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb on NATO efforts to help stabilize the African continent.
NATO cooperation with African Union started back in 2005 with the establishment of the liaison office in Addis Ababa, and it's been growing steadily ever since. One of the main reasons why we started expanding the cooperation is because we as NATO, through our strategic direction south, are recognized of potential problems or potential negative effects that are coming from the African continent, and it's affecting the European continent too.
You think of the migration crisis. What are you working on now to help stem that problem?
We just established about a year and a half ago what we call a NATO strategic direction south hub at Joint Force Command Naples. Now, that hub is our way of reaching out and making sure we connect and we coordinate all the activities with all the organizations in theater that are willing to share info with NATO.
And how has that been working?
It's been working actually very well. I mean, one of the things that we've been lacking in the past was the info flow between different players in the region. Now, with the establishment of this hub, this kind of opened doors to us to connect not just with the military assets in the region, but also with the non-governmental organizations or civilian organizations that are out there in Africa doing work. To share that and better coordinate. We've been seeing a steady progress. You mentioned that in 2016, in Warsaw Summit, we expanded that even more. Soon enough, you will see the NATO framework for the South, which should even more expand our coordination with the African continent.
NATO has a huge role with the African Union, which oversees AMISOM. I know that a lot of these countries were wanting to pull out of Somalia. They didn't. They decided in March not to. How critical is it for them to remain in Somalia to help fight off al-Shabaab?
Well, first of all, it's critical from the aspect of keeping the stability in the country. Now, I have to clarify, NATO's involvement in Somalia is only by providing strategic airlift and sea lift for the forces deployed. We don't have any NATO forces in Somalia, but supporting that through the sea lift and airlift We want to make sure that sustainability of the security situation is there. If NATO will be involved in future more directly in Somalia, I don't know, that's up to political leadership to decide. But projecting stability is one of the key roles of NATO. Now, that, again, it goes back, how is the situation in Africa affecting the rest of the world? Because it's not an African problem, it's an international problem that's affecting nations across the globe.
How involved is NATO with some of the planning of the African Union's role in Somalia? I know you said that operations-wise, they only deal with the lifts, but there's a lot involved with the planning, right?
Well, that's the key task of this liaison office in Addis Ababa. Their main role is to link up with African Union and provide support and SMEs in planning, operational planning. So that is the key element, whether it be by physically deploying there and providing that on location, or bringing those African officers and NCOs and leaders to NATO to provide that through education, through training, to direct engagements with NATO leadership. But it's mainly focused to operational planning and supporting operational planning.
Because it is October, and a year ago this month, there was a massive attack in Somalia. Considering the context of a year ago, is it still valuable to NATO to continue to support the government forces in Somalia?
Absolutely. It's all about maintaining a secure and safe environment. And again, addressing the problem at the source is the only way to do it.
Sergeant Major David Pitek is NATO's command senior enlisted leader for Allied Command Operations. He spoke exclusively with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in Germany. The 154 Contemporary African Art Fair continues to grow and expand, not only with its flagship fair in Marrakech, but also to satellite fairs in New York and London. The event's founder, Turaya El Gruar, spoke with Ricky Stryak about their expansion from one to three editions and the state of contemporary African art.
So this year, for example, in London, you know, in terms of galleries, we have the largest numbers of galleries. We had 43 galleries with over 130 artists, you know, represented from all over, you know, Africa. I think our visitor numbers, you know, have increased tremendously. We welcome 18,000 visitors this year. I mean, we obviously relatively a very small fair compared to, you know, the other big fairs that we around, like Frieze, for example, or Art Basel or FIAC, you know, but it gives us also an edge to be able to, I think, adapt, you know, our platform, you know, how and see how the, you know, our market is evolving as well.
Given this entrance into the mainstream, are there still stereotypes in this art world, in the mainstream art world, when people discuss African, quote, African art? And if so, how do you combat these stereotypes?
Listen, of course, they are there, but they're slowly being, you know, eroded by, you know, what we do, by losing the voice, you know, to a critical discourse. We have also a lot of different, you know, narratives, you know, when it comes to Africa and its diaspora, which are now nuancing, you know, the picture. I think one of our ways, you know, to really, in a way, either combat this or, you know, fight this is really using our 154 forum, which is our curated program of talks, and which we make sure that, you know, it's intergenerational and cross-disciplinary, you know, and it gives a program that's run alongside every edition of 154, where we invite, you know, different curators to program and actually ensure relevant, timely intervention of artists and curators in each location.
What are some of the contemporary movements, or who are some of the contemporary artists on the continent that you personally, and professionally obviously, are most excited about at the moment?
Obviously, it's very difficult for me to like pinpoint one or two artists, you know, for by any chance I'm excited about that. I mean, you know, we've seen a very new and young generation, you know, of photographers that did extremely well in on the continent. And even like when you talk or think about Edson Chagas, you know, who won the Golden Lion in Venice, you know, who's being awarded this year, you know, at the Smithsonian. But there's a whole, you know, group of photographers. For Hisham Ben Nasoud in Morocco, you know, who's I think his work has evolved, you know, tremendously from self-portraiture to now, you know, going into humoristic surrealism, you know, type of work. I'm also very impressed, you know, with the quality of the shows that you can now see on the continent. You know, for example, this summer, the Gallery 1957 put like this unbelievable show from this Nigerian artist Maduka Olaf at Dubai.
That was Turayo L. Glawi, founder of the 154 Contemporary African Art Fair. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Washington, D.C. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the latest FIFA ranking released by the World Governing Football Body on Thursday. Tunisia remain the top-ranked side in Africa and are up one place to 22 globally. They are followed by Senegal, who maintained the same spot they were last month, while Nigeria moved up four places to third in Africa and 4-4 in the world. Congo and Morocco are in fourth and fifth places, respectively, to wrap up Africa's top five. Just six countries moved up five places or more on October's FIFA World Rankings. Five of those are from Africa. And now to the Confederations Cup, where Al-Masri's director of football, Ibrahim Hassan, has revealed that the referee for their game against AS Vita asked for a bribe and at the same time claimed that they managed to record the incident. Al-Masri crashed out of the CAF Confederations Cup after a 4-0 defeat to Congolese side AS Vita in the second leg of the semi-final on Wednesday evening. And now to Nigeria, where Enugu Rangers won a dramatic Football Association's Cup final after coming from 3 goals down against Kano Pillars to force a shootout and win 4-2 from the sport. The victory means Rangers have now ended a 35-year FA Cup and also picked the ticket to represent Nigeria in next season's CAF Confederations Cup. Uzochukwu Ugonna and Calvin Hoya, both Rangers players, had this to say.
One thing I believe in this game, that we try our best until we just give ourselves that we cannot lose this game. So that's the only thing that we agreed on inside the dressing room, that those games, no matter how the 3 goes down, that we ain't going to lose it. So that's one thing that's pretty lead us to win the victory, to win the cup here.
Looking at the magnitude of this final, we've never had it this good.
Elsewhere in Kenya, Football Kenya Federation President Nick Mundwewa has called for the fast-tracking of the operationalization of Kenya's sports fund, claiming that failure to do so might hinder Kenya's Harambee Starlets from taking part in their second consecutive African Women Cup of Nations. The Continental Showpiece kicks off on the 17th of November and will last until the 1st of December, with Harambee Starlets in Group B alongside defending champions Nigeria, South Africa and Zambia.
The sports fund is the solution for funding national teams. Because as you know, in football, a national team cannot wear an advertisement on their jersey. It's prohibited. And without that, sometimes getting the proper sponsorship you need is a problem.
And finally, the South African national under 17 women's soccer team coach, Simfiwe Ndludu, has named 21 players for the Junior FIFA World Cup in Uruguay next month. President of the South African Football Association, Danny Jordan, has expressed his confidence in the team, saying it has the potential to become the first South African team to progress past the group stage at a FIFA World Cup. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An opposition leader in Ethiopia says the appointment of the country's first female president in its modern history will serve as an encouragement to women and girls in Ethiopia who have been marginalized for so long. And that's it for this Friday, October 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very good weekend.
Hello, friends. This is Sunday Shomari, host of Let's Talk. Join me Monday for another exciting edition of your show. Our topic next week will be sibling rivalry. This will be Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
A recent report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change paints a rather gloomy picture of the future of planet Earth. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo. Please join Peter Frumhoff from the Union of Concerned Scientists and me for the science edition of Press Conference USA when we discuss the report and its possible implications. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.